I think that that process, finding that process, is about saying, what is the correct process for me? And I think every athlete probably ends up exploring that deterministic side of things. Like, I'm just going to train super hard, and then you don't do well and you wonder why. And then you're like, oh, that's actually not what the process is for me. Like, I need to have fun. I need to talk to people. I need to be friends with my fellow athletes. I need to read. I need to travel. Like, all of that stuff is just, if not more important than like picking up a weight and putting it down or whatever.
That's decorated pioneer and professional downhill mountain biker Elliot Jackson, sharing how he discovered that his success as an athlete relied as much on fun, connection, reading, and travel, as much as, and if not more than, his physical training. He spent a decade competing professionally on the World Cup circuit and representing the United States. Elliot is now an analyst, commentator, and host for Red Bull TV. In this thoughtful conversation, we find out how shifting his focus away from results has helped him earn his best results. And we go deep on what he means when he says, you have to turn off to turn on. You're listening to the Be a Good Wheel podcast, the show where we explore what it means to be a good wheel by digging into scientific research and personal stories about human potential and performance. I'm your host, Amber Pierce. Today, we're diving into the world of adrenaline and determination with a philosophical twist. Our guest has not only conquered some of the world's most technical trails, but has also reshaped the landscape of mountain biking. Strap in, because we're about to explore the extraordinary journey of Elliot Jackson. Elliot's story began at the age of 4 when he inherited a motocross bike from his older brother Andrew, igniting a passion that would set the wheels in motion for a remarkable life on two wheels. By 15, he had already clinched a handful of motocross national championship titles, but the allure of something new beckoned. At 18, Elliot shifted gears to downhill mountain bike racing, and he soon found himself standing at the starting line of his first World Cup downhill in Val di Sole, Italy. How he got there is a wild story you won't want to miss. After a decade of racing the World Cup circuit and representing the U.S. at multiple world championships, Elliot transitioned to the more fun events, showcasing not only his prowess on the trails, but also honing his skills as a race analyst. As one of the first Americans to race downhill mountain bike in Europe, he blazed a trail for other athletes, and more recently, he established the Grow Cycling Foundation to create access and community in cycling for folks underrepresented in the industry. Elliot Jackson's journey to becoming a pro mountain biker is nothing short of cinematic, and indeed has come full circle as he can now be found on Red Bull TV, bringing the performances and stories of other athletes to life. Elliot is a true polymath, counting professional gaming, music production, and software development among the many roles he's filled. With a penchant for voracious reading and deep reflection, his insights cut deep, much deeper than a summary of his accomplishments can portray. In this episode, we hear from Elliot about how his journey from motocross to mountain biking and television have contributed to the many facets that make him not only a remarkable athlete, but also a visionary force in the cycling world. We are here today with former professional downhill bike racer, Elliot Jackson, who is also now a commentator, analyst, expert for Red Bull, and co-host of the Red Bull Just Ride podcast with Rob Warner. Welcome, Elliot.
Thank you, Amber. I know. I never know how to introduce myself. Like, which thing do I care about today? But I'm super excited to talk to you.
So many hats that you've worn over the years. It's really fun. So there's just so much that we can dig into today. I am really interested in your inner world and what it takes mentally to have competed at that level of downhill mountain biking, which is really intense, and kind of how that's evolved into this now post-racing career of yours. And from the outside looking in, downhill mountain bike seems pretty extreme. And for folks who are not that familiar with this discipline, let me just paint a quick picture. You're dropping down insanely steep terrain that is intentionally highly technical. You have less than a few minutes to get from start to finish. You're going as fast as you can on a specially made bike that has no motor, and yet you're trying to propel it as quickly as you can. You're getting up to speeds of, what, 80K an hour? And it's pretty wild. And I don't know, when I think of doing something like that, I think, you know, of just fearlessness. And I'm curious, are you fearless? Was that something that you needed to be a professional downhill mountain biker?
That's a way better description than I ever give. So gonna steal some of that. it's so funny because I, like, just in general life, like, I'm very cautious. Like, I'm super risk averse, super low pain tolerance. Like, I'm just not that guy. And I think it's interesting you kind of like paint that picture, because I think for my entire career, I kind of, what is it? Not so much struggled with it, but that idea externally. And I think a lot of the time, even from the inside of teams or team managers, like, on one hand, you have this idea of just kind of shut your brain off, take a bunch of risk on your World Cup finals run. Like, one of the things that I always think is interesting is you should probably only be able to do your World Cup finals run one time, because if not, then you probably weren't quite at that limit. If you go over, right, like, there's a big mistake or a crash. If you go under, then somebody else probably got a little bit closer than you. And so on one side, you have this idea of, like, trying to get as close as you can to the limit. And on the other side, that's totally not who I am and not why I rode my bike. So, I wouldn't say I'm fearless. But I think downhill mountain biking for me was really, really, really fun. It was just satisfied, I think, like, so much of my personality and, like, what I love to do on the bike.
That's so interesting. Okay. So on the one hand, you're saying that's not who you were. And yet on the other hand, you're saying it satisfied exactly who you were. So can you explain that?
Yeah, totally. So let's see. I think it's interesting maybe even to go back to, like, how I got into downhill riding, because I grew up, you know, I grew up, like, riding dirt jumps in my backyard with my brother building stuff, and neighborhood kids would come over and crash and stuff like that. And then I started racing motocross, and we were super, super serious in motocross. Rode for Kawasaki, like, kind of dropped out of school and everything to do that. We were, like, kind of, like, professional amateur riders. Stopped doing that when I was 15 or so. And then I got my first downhill bike when I was 18, and it was, like, this combination of the bike, like, my dirt jumping background. Like, even when I was racing motocross and stuff like that, I just loved riding BMX dirt jumps. Never raced BMX, but just loved riding and digging and stuff. And downhill mountain biking was the perfect combination between those two. And so I just happened to meet this mountain biker, and he, at our dirt jumps, we would make fun of him because mountain biking wasn't cool, but he convinced me to go with him to ride mountain bikes. And then we went up to Whistler, and I was like, this is really, really cool. I really love this. And then he happened to be into racing. And so he showed me all of these races and these Earth movies and this movie called Three Focus. And I, you know, it was back when you had it on DVD and stuff. I just, like, wore out the DVD. And I was like, this is really what I want to do. I want to travel around, and I want to race my bike, and I want to go to these World Cup races. The tracks look super cool. And so the thing I think that was really enticing from the beginning was, it was the whole, like, package, right? Like, racing in Europe, racing these tracks and stuff like that, doing something that was similar to what I had done. And I think that was the intro. And then after that, it kind of, once I got into it, it was more of an exploration of, like, why do I love this kind of thing?
Oh, that's interesting. So you came in with a conviction that you love this, and then it wasn't until after you were in it that you started to kind of dig into the why behind why you loved it.
Totally. I think so. Like, I'll tell this story actually of, like, my first year, because I think looking back on it, I was just so naive. We So I got my first bike when I was 18 or so. And I was like, I don't really care about anything but going to ride a World Cup. And you needed pro points. And so I was, well, first you need a pro license. And so I was in Cat 1 or whatever. You start in Cat 1 and you have to win 2 Cat 1 races. So I went up to this, went up to Sea Otter, like big festival, got on the, won the race. But it was funny because a dude in second was like, man, you're a little bit fast. And I was like, man, I wouldn't have won. You would have won. And so I ended up getting my pro license. And then after that, you needed DCI points. So I just went around with me and my mom. Like, we didn't have any sponsors. I didn't care about any sponsors or anything like that. Just like had saved up some money from working at a bookstore. And we went to New York. I remember I crashed there. And then we went to national championships. And I qualified 5th in the pro class, and kind of nobody knew who I was or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, cool, like this is perfect. All I need to do is get a top 20. Went to finals and like crashed. And I was just super devastated. I felt like I was going to get a podium, like first national championships, and I didn't get my points. And so I had read the rule book like front to back. And I went up to the kind of the, I don't know what you call them, the commissaire, like USA Cycling sports director. And I was like, man, I know that you can do a national team jersey. So you can go on the national team. Can I go to a World Cup? And he was like, well, there's Wyndham this year, which was the first World Cup in the US from a really long time. And he's like, a lot of people want to go. And I was like, well, what about Italy? And he was like, well, that's next week. And I was like, so what about Italy? And so I ended up flying home, and me and my mom and my brother flew to Italy, and it was my first time out of the country. Yeah, I didn't know what was going on and like what jet lag was. My phone bill was super like whatever. And I didn't take any tools or anything like that. It was just like me with my bike flipped upside down behind like this $1 million specialized rig or whatever. And me and my brother just like, you know, we walked the track a bunch, and in qualifying, I was trying this gap and broke my chain device, and my derailleur went into my spokes, and I wasn't able to pedal. But it was Val di Sole is a super, super steep track, and you don't really have to pedal except for the start. And I was like, man, I flew all the way to Italy and I'm not going to qualify. And I was like, man, like you can still do it. Just like try to like not touch the brakes as much as you can or whatever. And I ended up qualifying. It was 80 people qualified, and I ended up qualifying like 74th or something. And at the time, it was a kind of a big deal because not that many Americans qualified at the time.
And, it's your first World Cup?
It was my first World Cup.
That part?
Yeah. And so, I ended up like having to go around to all these pits, like literally went to, you know, the specialized pit and SRAM, and I didn't know anyone. And my mom, like I gave my mom a list, and she would just like go to different pits and be like, do you have a wheel that we could borrow? Do you have like a derailleur that we could borrow, or like whatever? And, you know, got into finals with this bike that looked completely different and didn't do much better. I think I got like 60 something, but it was such a cool experience because it was the introduction to like that mountain bike community, I feel like, of just everyone like helping and everything, and introduction to this race. Like the tracks were just so much bigger, so much faster, so much cooler. And I think that was kind of why I fell in love with it, was just, you know, if you said like the first bit was like, I feel like I'm going to really like this. That whole experience of that year was like, okay, I really want to do this. And ended up next year, got on Yeti, and started my like pro career. But it was, and one of the stories that I laugh about always, and my mom saw this dude sitting in the curb or something like that afterward. And she was like, that guy looks really sad. You should go and talk to him. I was like, oh, mom, that's Greg Minar. And she was like, oh, I don't know who that is, but you should go and talk to him. He looks like he could use a friend or whatever. And for people who don't know, Greg is like the most winning rider, greatest of all time, downhill mountain biker. And so I went up and talked to him, and now Yeah, like he's one of my best friends or whatever, you know. But my mom was like, just go and talk to that kid or whatever over there.
Oh my gosh. What was that conversation like?
I think I was just like, hey, you don't know who I am, but I know who you are. Mom said I should come and talk to you. And he's super nice. So I'm sure he was just like, hey, nice to meet you.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing. I love that. People don't realize how approachable a lot of these top level athletes are, that you could just rock up to somebody who's one of the most accomplished athletes in the discipline in the world and sit down and be like, hey, you don't know who I am, but my mom said I should come talk to you. Like, that's completely acceptable. And, you know, right, most of these athletes would have all the time in the world for that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's super cool that mountain biking, I think, and I think probably cycling in general has stayed like that, where the athletes aren't behind a bunch of velvet ropes and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you glossed over something that I want to make sure we don't gloss over. You got your start in motocross, but when you stopped motocross, you had 5 national championship titles to your name?
Something like that.
You were no slouch. This wasn't like, oh, we did some motocross for a while. This was like very high level stuff. This wasn't just, you know, oh, it dabbled as a hobby. Like, you weren't kidding when you said we were going for it.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. It's something I think that was, it was super nice because it set up a bunch of stuff in my life. Got to spend so much time with my family, got to understand how sports worked. And I said that, like, I didn't go to school. Like, we did homeschool in like 6th grade, and then I kind of just stopped going to school. But my family, both my parents are entrepreneurs, and so they had always had these amazing lessons of like, okay, we're going to try to ride for Kawasaki. Like, why would they sponsor you guys? Like, what's our budget for the year and stuff like that. So I think it allowed me to develop a bunch of skills when I went and raced mountain bikes on my own, of just understanding value and understanding how companies think and being able to just navigate the space and all that stuff.
It's an MBA where the rubber meets the road, like literally.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
You're just in there learning by doing.
Yeah, for sure.
Forget theory. We're just going straight to application. Let's do this.
Yeah, yeah. Don't mess it up, because then we won't have a ride this year.
There we go. So there was a 3-year gap, though. So you had incredible success in motocross, and then you stopped when you were 15, and then it wasn't until you were 18 that you got going with downhill mountain biking. What brought on the end of the motocross, and why the 3-year gap?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, motocross, my family kind of just was over it. My brother, he's 3 years older than me. He would have gone pro and raced supercross and stuff the next year. And I think he was at a point in his life where he's just like, this isn't really what I want to do. My mom was like, it's super dangerous. At the time, like, amateurs didn't really get paid. So we were, it was like expensive still with all the travel. And I was just like, well, if my family's not doing it, I guess, like, I don't want to do it. And so, went to community college, like, got my high school diploma, did a couple of university classes. And that, I guess that was really when I started riding dirt jumps a lot. We had a couple dirt jump spots near me. So it was just, I guess I was just a normal kid, like, just hanging out with friends, going to school. Yeah, riding my bike. Like, it was just a super normal life at that point, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until you were 18 that you started, like, really kind of get this glimmer in your eye about the downhill mountain biking.
Yeah,
and that was
for sure.
Specifically because, like, you encountered a friend who was introducing you to it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like, at one of those dirt jump spots, was friends with him. And, like, he was just the dude who rode mountain bikes at dirt jump spot, like a hardtail. Like, now I would ride the same thing. But yeah, he convinced me to go to, like, a local spot. I think it just all progressed super fast, where maybe there was some part of me that I've always been, super ambitious. And I think we'll probably get into it later, but thinking about, like, what is the common thread between you know, between all of the stuff you do in your life. And like thinking mm-hmm. back, I kind of understand that a little bit more now. And also, I guess when I was 16, 17, I was like playing video games a lot. Like I was like a pro video game player for a little bit. So I was traveling
just
around.
Just add another hat. A little bit.
I forgot about that. Yeah, totally.
Just happened to be a pro video game player.
Yeah, my mom would take me to these video game tournaments in like Northern California and stuff. Yeah, so I think probably like the next competitive thing in my life, maybe.
Okay, so it wasn't like you just dropped out of competition completely there. It was like you were kind of going from one competitive arena to the
next. I guess so, yeah. I felt like I was, I mean, it's not like I was at a level of like where I was in mountain biking or whatever. For sure it was like a hobby more so because there wasn't really a thing back then, but I guess it was, yeah, it's just like my little break.
I love it. So once you decided to go all in on downhill, which I love that you just rocked up to the official and you're like, so World Cup.
So naive. Yeah.
Next week.
What do you think?
Let's do this. But you ended up racing at the World Cup and World Championship level for 8 years, representing the US, mm-hmm. representing professional teams. And you said, and you already mentioned this, that you knew you loved it from the start and you went all in with that conviction. And it wasn't until you were actually in it that you started really thinking about why maybe you love it. So tell me a little bit about that exploration. When did you start wondering why?
Yeah, super interesting. I feel like because raced for a couple years, did pretty good. And then I remember I got on Pivot. So I raced for Yeti, then I got on Pivot. And there was this moment where I got a podium at Crankworx Rotorua. So Crankworx like a festival. And at the time, that year was really competitive. So like a G. Atherton and Sam Hill and Luke Bruni, like a lot of the World Cup athletes were there. And I got second. I remember going on the podium and I was super happy. I remember walking off the podium. I was like, kind of feel like I did just a couple hours ago, like nothing's really changed. And I was like, I feel like this is supposed to be the moment that I've mm-hmm. been working toward. This is supposed to be what I love more than everything, is like standing like, you know, on the podium and beating people and stuff like that. And so I think it was kind of that, which was like, I think in most things you have a carrot and a stick, but you just normally mm-hmm. don't catch the carrot. And mm-hmm. so I like caught the carrot and I was like, well, this is not the right carrot. Like I'm doing this for the wrong reasons. Like it doesn't taste nearly as good as I thought it was going to. So I felt like after that, I kind of explored like what is the more sustainable source of motivation. And I think for me, I realized that it was just this pursuit of like mastery. I think where mastery in a sense, not in a sense of like, I want to be finished, but mastery in a sense of like, I would go to New Zealand to train every year. And how do I just get more perfect? Like, yeah. How do I train better? How do I like prepare better mentally? Like, how do I, you know, control my bike better? I want to go 2 inches to the left of this. You know, I want my times to be within half a second every single run. And that was just so interesting to me, like just pulling the string to see how deep it would go. And that was, I think, what maybe the second half of my career was about.
I love that. And I find it really interesting that a lot of what you just described in terms of that pursuit of mastery is so process oriented. And a lot of what you just listed as the things that captured your passion, they weren't specific results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think there is almost that trope now of, oh, trust the process. It's about the process rather than the outcome and things like mm-hmm. that. And I think once, for me, like digging into that, it was that idea really is about finding what you love in the process, not so much the process in service of the outcome.
Yeah. That's a really insightful and like big differentiator, right? Because
totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about what that was like for you.
Ironically, I think that it was easier, much easier said than done. Like if I think that there was a period where I, I understood that. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of my career, I think I totally lost it. But I think it was just about every piece of it. Like my probably one of my best years was like my second to last year. And I got some more podiums. I got some great World Cup results. But then also I was just like training super hard. You know, I had a trainer, Jarrett Kolick, and we were in Santa Barbara. And so I would like go up there and I would stay with his parents every day. We would just trying to find a little bit more, trying to do an exercise a little bit more better or perfect and, you know, giving the feedback. But I think in addition to that, there was more to it. So one of the things that Greg ironically has said to me is like, you have to be able to turn off to turn on. And so it's also about like, how do you create the most variance there almost? And so in between the races, like we'd be in France or whatever, you know, I love to go to Paris. I love to hang out in Geneva. And so the process is not deterministic. Like sports are like the least deterministic thing. I think from the outside, they look deterministic, right?
Yes.
Oh, that person is training super hard. Like to win, all you have to do is just train for 8 hours a day and train harder than everyone else. And I wish it were that easy. Like
I know, right? Wish, like, that'd be so nice.
Totally, totally.
Just this linear so relationship.
That, totally, right? Yeah, yeah, like that would be amazing. That would make like life so simple. It's just like work really hard and
And you'll achieve everything you ever wanted.
Totally. So I think that that process, like finding that process is about saying, what is the correct process for me? And I think every athlete probably ends up exploring that deterministic side of things. Like I'm just going to train super hard and then you don't do well and you wonder why. And then you're like, oh, that's actually not what the process is for me. Like I need to have fun. I need to talk to people. I need to, you know, be friends with my fellow athletes. I need to read. I need to travel. Like all of that stuff is just, if not more important than like picking up a weight and putting it down or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so much of what you're saying is really resonating with me. And one of the things that I've observed over the years in myself and in others is that athletes who have a really long career, and I mean, you were racing at this level for a decade, which for folks listening, that's a long time to be able to sustain performance at that level. I mean, it takes a lot to do that just from a talent and a work ethic perspective, but there's so much more that goes into it because you have a lot of athletes that come into the sport with a lot of talent and a lot of work ethic, and they're blown in 2 or 3 years, right. Or maybe even a year, right? Like, but to sustain it at that level, what I found is, it requires cultivating a lot of joy in what you do, and it doesn't necessarily come with the outcomes. And a lot of what you were just describing, you know, connecting with other people, the travel, reading, like these are things that are really joyful moments embedded in the larger process of what you're doing as an athlete. And I think sometimes there's this perception that athletes are really superhuman in terms of discipline, and discipline being, wow, they just have this superhuman ability to grind it out and do things that they don't want to do over and over again. But that's not sustainable. And that's not what you're doing, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what was it like for you? Like, did that, did you go through that same process of like figuring out what the joyful moments were?
It's so funny because a lot of what you're saying, I'm just like, like I'm just nodding so hard inside because I had a really similar kind of narrative arc, if you will, where coming into the sport, it's like, okay, I'm going to achieve these like benchmark, super high, you know, set a bunch of standards for myself. And, you know, I'm going to get this result and this result and this result. And then you start to get results. And I mean, it's fun. Like, it's totally, really fun to win.
Yeah, it's great.
But but it somehow never lives up to what you imagined it was going to be, or it doesn't last as long. And then you kind of realize that's not the thing that's going to sustain your fire. And the pursuit of mastery, the way that you just capture that in those three words was, that really struck a chord with me because that was very much what I felt at the end too, which makes it hard because then it's like, well, when do you stop? Right? Because that's a process that has no end.
Totally. Yeah, totally. 100%.
How was it for you? How did you know when you were ready to step away?
Yeah, it's interesting because my last year probably had my best year results-wise. Wasn't super consistent, but I had like little flashes of brilliance. And I just hated riding my bike.
Oh, man. Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, totally. It was, I think, a bunch of external stuff like when I was saying that I totally lost that pursuit of mastery, I think that because I had felt so good, I had put so much work into it, just did everything the opposite of what I just said. Like, I was like, man, I know I trained harder than everyone else. I know that, like, I'm good. I know everything's working right. I know whatever, like, why am I not doing well? And I think just getting caught up in that just kind of ruined it for me a bit. And there was a time, maybe halfway through the season, I was at a race and I was like halfway down the track. And I remember thinking, like, I would rather be anywhere but here, like doing this right now. And it was like in the middle of my race run. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'm probably done. okay, I don't want to, this is like, I can't be thinking about this in the middle of a race run.
No.
And so I think, yeah, like I think it was hard. And there was probably two paths or whatever where I could have refocused, realized that. I mean, I think I realized it in the moment, refocused and said, okay, let me get back to basics and figure out my life. But I think I've also always wanted to do not more as in the diminishment of sport, but like different things. Like I just have such, I think, broad interests and stuff like that. And I said, you know, I think maybe now is the right time for me to go and do a bunch of other things.
Yeah. Because I mean, to your, what you said earlier really resonates, that when you're engaged in the pursuit of mastery, there's no end to it, right? You don't achieve mastery and you're like, oh, I'm good, I'm done.
Totally.
Because it's just a constant cultivation of it, but you have, which means it forces you into the position of making a decision, an active and intentional decision to walk away, because you don't, there isn't a finish line with that approach.
Right.
Unless you create it for yourself. And you do have so many hats and so many varied interests that I'm not at all surprised that you were kind of like, yeah, I'm ready to pursue mastery on a different path now. Cause
yeah, I mean, I think even just realizing that like, if that's the core thing, the core driver in your life, like the things you do are just kind of outlets for that driver. And so I would say that I still pursue that in everything that I do, and that downhill mountain biking was like the vehicle for it for a decade or so.
Yeah it's just a decade, no big deal.
Right, yeah, a really long time. really long time. Yeah totally.
I mean, it is, and I don't want that to be diminished in the least, because I think that's
no,
it's truly remarkable. It really is. Especially for somebody who is saying that, I mean, I think it's so funny that you don't identify as somebody who's like a real risk taker. I mean, you're like, but I'm going to dedicate a decade of my life to downhill mountain bike racing. I think it's amazing.
Well, you know what? I've had this conversation, or like I've thought about this little idea of risk versus like in a pro's eyes versus like an amateur's eyes. And I always say that pros almost by definition are taking less risk because they're riding so much more. Like when I would go to New Zealand, I really loved and kind of needed a lot of bike time. So I would do like 200 runs or so in like 2 months. And to do 200 runs and then stay healthy. And then you think of the like weekend warrior who goes out like one weekend and gets hurt. You're like, well, like who is taking more risk?
Yeah. Well, and when, I mean, not that anybody wants to crash, right? But when you're at the professional level, it's your entire livelihood. And and a lot of what determines the success of an entire career is how much you can minimize illness and injury, right?
Because
things set you back so far. Especially if your competitor has a really clean season and never gets, you know, never 100%. Gets injured, never gets sick. Like it makes a huge difference. So I think people forget about that part of it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That I have to start at the starting line to like get the results. So that's like a prerequisite.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knew? We'll be back with more from Elliot after this quick break. If you appreciate what we're doing and want to support the show, you can support us directly through Patreon and Ko-Fi. Both Ko-Fi and Patreon enable you to help us cover production costs through memberships with perks,
like access to bonus episodes, merch, and more. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi, as they don't take a fee. You can find it at ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Unlike Ko-Fi, Patreon takes an 8% fee. That said, if you're already supporting other creators on Patreon, you can support us there too. Find us on Patreon at patreon.com/beagoodwheel. That's patreon.com/beagoodwheel. For even more ideas on how you can support the show, check out beagoodwheel.com/support. That's beagoodwheel.com/support. If the idea of being a good wheel resonates with you, check out the Be a Good Wheel community at beagoodwheel.com/community. The community is a virtual, membership-based organization of like-minded folks keen to continue exploring what it means to be a good wheel beyond the podcast. Connect with other folks on topics that go way beyond the bike, toward meaningful application and fellowship across industries and aspirations. Fuel your curiosity and inspiration by joining today. Learn more and join us at beagoodwheel.com/community. That's beagoodwheel.com/community. And now back to our conversation with professional downhill racer and Red Bull TV personality, Elliot Jackson.
Oh, that's really, I think it's funny that you had that moment in the middle of a race run where you were like, this is not where I want to be right now. And maybe I should stop doing this, because I definitely had some of those thoughts too. But in my case, I was a road racer. So my races lasted 3 to 4 hours. So I would be on the road with a few hours in having that thought. But I mean, you're in the middle, like you're going 80 kilometers an hour down the side of a cliff and you're like, maybe I want to be doing something else like that. I feel like, yeah. That's a slightly different situation.
Totally. Yeah. You had time to be like, well, I think I'm going to go to a vacation here. Maybe I'll go to Bali.
I think it was like far less risky for me to have that slightly distracting thought in the middle of a 4 hour race versus like a 2 minute race.
Totally. It's amazing. Totally. Yeah.
It's amazing. So you knew when you were ready to stop. What was the transition out of racing like for you?
And then in 2019, Red Bull reached out to me and said, we're starting this YouTube series and we want you to be the host.
Yes.
And I was like, huh, like that's really cool. And I thought about this a lot, like after the fact. And there is this idea of like this vulnerability flywheel where after I stopped race, or like kind of my last year, I built this website that pulled a bunch of data and put them up. It's called like World Cup Stats, because the results were just on a PDF sheet that came out too late. So I was like, we should do this. We need something better. So I built this website.
I'm just going to go fix this whole thing and build it. Sorry.
That was my software. That's my software engineering hat. My like super nerd, like 12 a.m. before a race, like on the computer.
Because that's what most racers are doing at 12 a.m. before the race. Sorry. Amazing. I love
it. So like in the vulnerability thing, I think that the culture of mountain biking was like not super nerdy. And it was really kind of hard for me to show that side of me. But at one point I was just like, I'm going to do this. So this thing happened where like the flywheel is like you're honest with yourself and you do the things that like are core to you, which then like shows visibility, like it creates like this, shows people what you do, which then brings you opportunity. And so because I was a racer and like doing this analysis stuff, Red Bull was like, oh, here's a downhill racer and he's an analyst and he's a communicator. Like what's the intersection of those things? It's this analysis show that we're doing on Red Bull TV, which then like brings success because it's all the stuff that you're really good at, which then makes it even easier to be honest, and then like creates more visibility, and that just spins around. But it's really hard to be honest, right? Like, because a lot of the time, especially now, like we're really incentivized to go really deep on one thing on social media. You should have one persona to succeed. You should, you know, back to the like determinism in sport kind of thing. And so that was kind of like my first exposure to that, like that idea of just like being who you are and it leading to success. And yeah, also like led to the Red Bull thing, which kept me in the bike world. And without that, I totally wouldn't even be talking to you right now, because I would have been off doing some random thing somewhere else, like not
another
in the bike
random
world. Yeah, totally.
Well, even that first step that you describe of the flywheel of being honest with yourself, that is easier said than done.
Totally.
That's really hard.
Yeah. How
did you take that first step? What did that look like for you?
I think it was just doing what I wanted without even saying it first, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I think for me, understanding that it's not going to resonate as much with people as the other pieces of your personality are. Like I was super into Instagram at that point. And there was just a formula where you post a picture of your bike, it gets however many thousand likes. If you post a picture of you in the mud, it gets this many likes. And, you know, post a picture of you like doing a jump or whatever, like it gets this many likes. And so like, that is the thing that people follow you for. And I remember when I launched that website, put it on my Instagram, and it got like 100 likes or something like that. And like no one cared.
Like orders of magnitude fewer likes.
Yeah, literally like literally what, 30 times or 40 times less.
Oh, wow.
And so like that was a thing. And then when I had put this little analysis piece on it where you could kind of see what people were clicking on, and people would come to the site and then you like click one or two things and then leave. And I was like, man, I just spent like a couple thousand hours like building this thing. And like, you're not going to explore around a little bit.
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah. And so I think it was not that I was deriving the value from likes, but it's almost just like, what feedback are you getting, right? Like,
yeah.
Instagram is just like some form of feedback. The people you talk to is some form of feedback, right? Like if I was programming, somebody would say something. If, you know, I wasn't training or something like that, somebody would say something. And so it's not so much that like the way I valued myself was like on how many likes it did or whatever, but it's just like just little mini friction points. And so yeah. I think that that's why the vulnerability piece, that's why being vulnerable is hard, right? Because as soon as you're vulnerable, not only does it open yourself up to friction and feedback that you're not maybe hoping for, but also it's in a place that you care a lot about. And yeah. So I cared way more about this website than like if somebody saw a picture of me and was like, oh, you have bad style. Like I was like, I don't, whatever. <You know? laughs> So yeah, like I think that that piece of it was like probably the way that I kind of started to understand of like really going back to that process idea of what is the core thing that motivates me? If maybe it's this mastery piece of trying to make the best website and trying to, you know, do the best broadcast or make the best YouTube series, then like that should be my North Star, and like showing all the pieces of me that need to be shown and doing what I need to do in service of the mastery component really helped me kind of get over that. What do I do if I get negative feedback or, you know, there's friction to me being vulnerable?
I love that. What you're describing to me, it's so true that we each have a sense of identity, a sense of self, and so much of our identity is reflected back to us from the world, right? Reflected back to us in our interactions with people, in our interactions online, in the form of likes on Instagram and social media. And as much as we'd like to believe that those things don't affect us, they absolutely do. And it's funny because I think, at least in my life, the moments where I've had a struggle with a loss of identity, it's been so clarifying because a loss of one identity helps me see who I am without all of these identities that are being reflected back to me. And it's hard. Totally. Like, it's not an easy process to go through to like examine 100%. Yourself in that way, right?
Oh my God. There's, I have this little talk that I give, and one of the pieces of it, when you talk about the loss of identity, like what we've been talking about are like these bullet points of my resume almost, right? Like you would say, yeah, okay, he was a motocross racer and he won some championships and then he went and rode mountain biking and he did this and got some podiums and blah, blah, blah. And then he was a Red Bull TV commentator and stuff. And so like that is what you see on a resume. But like, what would it look like if you explored the white space, like in between that, right? Like you would be the first one who would be like, oh yeah, he was a motocross racer. And then he lost his identity and didn't know what he was going to do with his life. And, you know, was just like cruising around with his friends or whatever. And then he discovered mountain biking and was all good. And then he lost his identity again and had no idea what he was going to do with his life, you know? And so I think that those, like the white space in between these like big moments of your life, like even going back to that idea of the variance of like turning off to turn on and like the white space in between is the hard part, but it's also where the growth happens and it gives you this blank canvas because as soon as you're there, like the opportunities are kind of endless. And as soon as you start pursuing something by definition and in a positive way, the opportunities and the places you can go kind of narrow. But I think that that blank canvas idea in between these moments of like success are almost the most interesting and exciting moments in life.
Tell me more about this. So I agree with you 100% there. And I think that that's a balance that I try to strike here on this podcast too, because you bring so much credibility because of those bullet points on your resume, because of what you've achieved. Right. But what we're talking about here is so much more of the white space and so much more of what's interesting, I think, and relatable for folks that, yeah, you're not just some freak of nature who just happened to be super talented and on a downhill bike. Like you too are a human being who struggles with identity and understanding who you are. But I really want to talk about this idea of turning off to turn on because you've mentioned it twice. It really caught my ear when you said it the first time. And the first time you said it, it meant one thing. And the second time you said it, it meant something else to me. So I'm really curious to hear what it means for you.
I think it is like the idea of contrast. You know, there's kind of like no good moments without the bad, like no growth without pain or whatever. And so I think that it's when I think about that, it is, what does it look like to almost deliberately cultivate it or lean into it kind of thing? And I think as an athlete, that is one of the hardest things to do. Mm-hmm. I think after I stopped racing, the thing that I, from the outside, the thing that is so much more apparent is you can be doing the right thing and things can go wrong. And I think that that was probably the thing that I missed most in my last year. And I was talking to like Finn Isles and like my friend Bernard Kerr too. They had like some really difficult moments in the season, like one at the beginning and one at the end. And the thing I said to both of them was like, man, you're doing everything perfect. Like you're doing like everything perfect. Like just keep doing what you're doing. Like you don't need to go and solve problems. Like, and they are better than I ever was. Like they get it. But I think that idea of when you're in that moment where everything is kind of going wrong, you feel like you need to solve problems or whatever, like you almost just have to lean into it and say, this is just part of it, instead of trying to push it away, you know, maybe similar to what I did is like, why isn't it happening now? Like, what am I doing? What do I need to fix or whatever, you know, and say, okay, everything is not where I want it to be. I'm just going to sit in this and like kind of try to figure it out. Like, I mean, for me, at least, like whenever I'm on like a vacation or sitting still, like that's where I have my best ideas or think of like the most interesting things. And so I think that idea of, to me, is also turning off, right? Like turning off the desire to fix things, turning off the desire to get out of the situation. Like even that idea of white space. Like I think that if you asked a lot of people, they would want to jump from one resume bullet point to the next. But I think that ideally, right, like you totally live in that white space moment, even though it is a bit uncomfortable.
Definitely. And I remember when I retired from the sport, I didn't know what I wanted to do next either. And a friend of mine described it as being in the hallway, which is another way of saying the white space. Like you've stepped through one door and the next one hasn't opened yet. And it's not a bad place to be. Right? It's just a hallway.
Totally.
But
well, man,
it's so uncomfortable.
There's a million doors you could go in. It's the best place to be.
It is and it isn't, right? Because sometimes
that choice
is so overwhelming. And then you think, oh, I have to pick the right one. But then eventually you realize there's more than one hallway and it doesn't have to be the right one. It totally. Can just be the right one for a little while. And
what did you, how did that go for you? Like what was the... What made the door that you took enticing?
Oh, man. It's funny. When I stopped, I didn't know what I wanted to do yet, but I kind of went back to when I got into the sport. I never in a million years would have thought that I would be a pro cyclist. Like, I didn't even know that the sport of cycling existed. You know, when I was growing up, I wanted to be a swimmer and that was everything. And even with swimming, it wasn't like you could be a professional swimmer. I mean, there are maybe a handful of athletes who can make a living off endorsements as swimmers, but it's not a revenue sport in the way that, you know, maybe basketball would be or soccer, but cycling was never on the radar. So I held on to this conviction, which I had proof of in my own life, that even if I didn't know what I wanted to do, it was possible that there was an opportunity for me that I couldn't even think of right now. I couldn't even imagine existed.
Sure.
And that gave me a lot of comfort. And that is actually what happened. I ended up taking a position as a product manager for Trainer Road in a software development company. And I am not a software developer, by the way. So I was working with engineers and I was managing product, but it was phenomenal. And I loved it. And if you had asked me 2 years before I retired what I wanted to do, would never have even been on my radar.
Totally. Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But getting back to this idea of turning off to turn on, there were two ways that reflected back to me. And I just want to check in with you on both of those, because the second one you brought up in context of walking away from the sport and identity. And it's an eloquent way of saying turning off these identities and these ways that we identify ourselves allows us to turn on to who we really are. And maybe to those aspects of ourselves that don't get reflected back as much or that do encounter friction that are as important as those that maybe generate more likes.
No, I think that's like exactly right. Yeah, 100%.
I love this too. And it's a different way of thinking about the same thing. So I love that saying is going to just echo in my mind for months after this interview. But the other way I was thinking about it was, in both sports that I've done, swimming and cycling, there were so many skills that I had to learn in order to be successful at the level that I wanted to compete at. And those skills, when you're learning a skill, you start out learning in a very mechanical way. And you're learning the steps and the step-by-step. Okay, first you do this, then you do this. And you're really trying and you're really thinking. But then you get to a point where, in order to pursue that mastery, your mind is, you know, whereas your mind has been the thing that's been your ally all of this time, in those last few steps of mastery, the mind is the thing that's getting in your way. And so you have to let go of the thinking that allowed you to learn it in the first place in order to achieve that mastery.
Yeah. There's this book that I read every couple of years called The Art of Learning. It's by this dude, Josh Waitzkin. He was the subject of this movie, Searching for Bobby Fischer. So he's a chess player.
Oh, yeah.
And then he went on to do Tai Chi push hands and is just the coolest thinker. But he talks about that. Like, I can't remember the exact language he uses, but it is that idea. Like, I think he says it's like form to leave form. So like, you have to practice and get so good at it. That way it's second nature. That way you don't even have to think about it. So like, I have to do so many reps on my bike and, you know, practice my left-hand turns or clipping out so many times that way I don't even think about clipping out, right? I can leave that idea of practice behind, or I can leave that idea of even thinking about it behind. Yeah. And so I love that idea for sure.
Yeah. And hearing you just in different interviews that you've done over the years, talking about when you were racing downhill and looking at lines and making those decisions. So I used to get nervous before a bike race, and my husband used to joke to me, he'd be like, why are you nervous? You have like 3 hours to figure it out.
Whereas, I love that.
Whereas for you, there is no time to figure anything out, because you have just a couple minutes and you're looking at fractions of a second that are going to make a difference in your line. And you're deciding what line to take down the side of a cliff, for, you know, lack of a better term. And overthinking, right, is going to be absolutely your enemy. And I think a lot of folks who, myself included, so I'm not a mountain biker, but I like to get out there and work on this and learn. And I know, because I've gone through this process in other sports and in other disciplines, that as an amateur, as a beginner, I'm thinking about a whole lot of stuff that an expert is not even paying attention to. And right, the difference between a beginner and an expert is really, the expert knows how much they don't actually have to pay attention to. And part of the reason they can do that is what you've just described, because all of that learning has been so integrated that it's no longer even landing on that radar of consciousness, right? Like, what you're seeing going down a hill is like a sliver of what I would be looking at and trying to process as a beginner.
Yeah, that is, I think that that's a perfect way to articulate it, because I think it is putting more space in the moment between the moments that you focus on. Like, when we walk, we don't look at like every single little crack. We just like pick a moment and it's like, I'm going to step there and then I'm going to step there. And I think that that never changes. Like, for me riding mountain bikes, and ironically, like, I've talked to a bunch of kind of road and gravel athletes, and I'm like, it's like, what do you think about, like, what's going on or whatever? And they're like, I don't know, you're kind of like focused the whole time. Like, there's always something to do, like you're shifting or doing this. And I think on the downhill mountain bike side, it feels like, oh, it's just over in a blink of an eye. But for me personally, my best races were when I could just recount every single little thing, like half a pedal here, 2 inches left there. Like, I'm going to lean over here, like put my tire on that rock, put my tire on that rock, boom, boom, boom. And like, going back to that idea of like putting more space in between what you think about as a beginner or as an expert, I guess, like, it's not that I'm like processing more than what a beginner would. It's that maybe the beginner is saying, there's a route here and another route here, and I need to put my tires on this one and then put my tires on this one. Where maybe an expert would say, oh, I can actually just like bunny hop over the whole thing. And like, I'm looking at a point 10 feet ahead, whereas a beginner would look at 2 feet ahead. But I think that that just like totally comes with experience, right? Of just saying, okay, I know what my bike's going to do. But I would think it would be similar for like other disciplines too, right? Like I know I can hold this wattage for this long and I don't have to think about like, is my heart rate here for like 10 seconds or whatever, you know, like I think it is interesting. Totally. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting thing to think about. And yeah, I'm imagining that I just think it's funny like that I'd be thinking about like seven things and you would just be thinking bunny hop.
Totally.
It's amazing. And I think this speaks to regardless of what you're doing, whether you're an athlete or not, I think a lot of people, you know, you dedicate yourself to something, whether it is a skill that's related to your career or parenting or whatever it is, but something that you've been learning and working on for a long time, what becomes normal was once really far out of reach.
Totally.
But it's so gradual that by the time you can do something that from the outside looking in is utterly remarkable, it feels so mundane to you from your own perspective. Because you're just like, this is normal. This is what I do every day. How is it? This isn't, this is nothing, right? And it can feed into that imposter syndrome, right? Of like, I'm not that good, but you have to step back and take stock of where you started. And it's just easy to lose sight of that, I think, in the process.
Yeah. There's a question that I love asking, which is, what today do you think is easy that you used to think was impossible? And like you ask that to athletes. I would be actually interested to hear your answer of that, Amber.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Like, you're really catching me off guard here. So let me think for a moment. Man, that is a tough one. I would say I don't know that I ever thought this was impossible, but it was a really big challenge for me for a long time. And that was letting go of the things that are outside of my control, just from like a mental like mindset standpoint. Because I think when I started going way back as an athlete, there was this idea in my head. It kind of goes back to that idea that like, oh, if you just work hard, you can achieve X, Y, and Z, right? So if I just worked hard enough that I would be able to control all of the things I needed to control in order to achieve the outcome I wanted. But the further into it you get, the more you realize how much is outside of your control. And it is a
totally.
Lot. I mean, it's a lot.
And it's a lot. Yeah, totally.
It could be really discouraging to come to that conclusion and realize, because I feel like the deeper into something that you get, the more and more there is that's beyond your control. And it's, it could be really demoralizing. But you learn that you control your controllables. So you focus your effort and attention on the things that are within your control. And you learn how to adapt on the fly when things don't go to plan, when the things beyond your control happen. And one thing I ended up getting very good at that was a huge challenge for me was being able to do that in real time and not letting it completely derail my motivation or my mindset, or, you know, instead of just completely giving up and being like, oh, well, you know, my ducks aren't all in a row anymore. I might as well just give up. Instead of doing that, being like, okay, how do I figure this out? How do I figure this out? And being able to do that in real time instead of just reflectively, I think was a really big one for me. But I want to hear what yours is.
Yeah. I mean, even just on that, I feel like when you look at athletes from the outside, you're like, and they win a race or do well or something like it's like, oh, everything went perfect. But there was like a bunch of moments inside of that that like the world was ending.
Yeah, 100%. Like it was not pretty.
Yeah, totally. I mean, man, even just a simple one. Like I talked about clipping in and clipping out. When I moved to clips, I was like, this is impossible. Like I've ridden flats my whole life. And the first day I rode clips, I like went to the sandy downhill track and I just fell over like every turn. And so I was like, man, I don't know if I could do this. Like this is, I'm a World Cup racer and I need to be able to take my feet off the pedals at some point. But yeah, after a while, I don't even think about it anymore.
Yeah, that's a good one. And it's funny that those things, I like grounding myself too with working with people who are not, you know, are like pretty early in their journey in the sport, because it's easy for me to forget the things that I didn't know how to do or the things that were challenges in the beginning. And it's good to kind of ground myself and remember that, you know, these were things that I had to learn too. And it's humbling too. It's humbling on one hand. On the other hand, it reminds me to give myself credit for all of the growth that I've been able to manage.
Yeah, for sure. Right. Like the thing that you are struggling with now will be that thing in a couple of years or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's so easy to forget that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's been recurring as a theme in this conversation, which I find really interesting, is that a lot of what you describe as kind of lighting your fire, motivating you, sustaining you over the course of this very successful, very long career as a professional athlete, it wasn't specific goals, right? I mean, and I'm sure that you had goals and that you set goals and that helped. But what's really surfacing now more authentically is like a deeper sense of purpose, that pursuit of mastery, a deeper sense of meaning that isn't tied to like one discrete goal.
Yeah. I don't know. I used to have this metaphor for this, but then somebody told me it was the opposite of this. but it's like, what does it look like for a goal to be not so much? Okay. I'm just like going to try to make up a new one.
Yeah,
because old one didn't work. But it's like, what does a goal look like to not be like so much like a destination, but just like a something in the distance that you're never really going to reach, but like it directionally points you in the right way. Yeah, like it's like,
I like that.
I want to be, rather than it's like, I want to get first place, it's like, I want to be the best I can be on my bike. Mm-hmm. And I know that if I am the best I can possibly be, then that other one will come if I'm doing everything right or whatever, you know. But like, I think even just going back to the stuff that we've talked about, like, how do we make like non-deterministic goals?
Right.
I mean, yeah. And it's like, it's not to say that you can't make, like, you race to win, right? Like, that is the whole thing, is you're trying to beat everyone else. And so it's not to say that I'm like, oh, like, don't care about a podium or whatever, you know. But I think that it's, for me, I guess it's always been more sustainable to say, like, how do I point myself in the right direction and just work as hard as I possibly can at moving toward this thing? And the other stuff just has to fall in place.
Yeah, I think the higher and higher the level you get, the more you do realize how much is beyond your control. And so setting those really concrete, you know, outcome-based goals gets harder and harder because your competition is stiffer, right? You can't control what your competitors do. And that can't be the thing that sustains you because it's just not sustainable. And so moving that from a destination viewpoint to a directional viewpoint makes a lot of sense.
For sure. And I mean, I think that's why you hear in so many interviews, athletes are like, oh, I just want to do my best. Or like, I mean, like sometimes there is a moment where you're like, I'm going to win. Like today this is what I am going to do, etc. But I think that can feel boring when you hear it in interviews. But I think it's also that idea, because if you meet a goal, you're kind of like meeting expectations, right?
Yeah. And then
because you said it at the beginning, you're like, I expect to be able to do X by the end of the year. And so when you did it, it's like, cool, like gold star, you met expectations. And if you don't, then, you know, you didn't meet expectations and it's like a devastating thing. You know, that's like trivializing it a little bit, but I feel like mentally, maybe that was my experience, like getting on the podium was just like, I met some expectation. And then what am I supposed to kind of do now? Do I just set another one where it's like, now I want to be at the top? And of course you do, but it's kind of just an outcome of it rather than the purpose, I guess. It's one of those things where it's a little bit hard to articulate because it's an and, right? Like, of course you want to be you want to be the best. You want to stand on the podium like as many times as possible. You want to achieve what you set out to get some, you know, hit some watts, get some time up a hill. Like for me, that was always really important when I was training. But then, and it has to be more than that.
Yeah. Well, because both can exist, right? Like you can have a deeper, bigger sense of purpose that is guiding your direction. And then you can be setting these kind of smaller stepping stone goals, but with the goal that's concrete, the upside is limited, like you were just describing. Right. It's like the upside is limited because you're either going to meet expectations, which is sort of like meh, and then And then, or you don't, and then that's a pretty big downside, right? That's right. Can be just utterly devastating. And so
totally,
and it's probably better than meh, but it's a limited upside with this like gaping downside. Whereas if you pair those goals with a bigger sense of purpose, then you can really get somewhere with it.
Yeah. I think like going back to what you said of understanding, like if I have a bigger sense of purpose, I understand that a bunch of stuff is out of my control. So it would be great if I can meet these expectations, but I understand that a bunch of stuff could go wrong and I might not be able to get there kind of thing.
And then that not being able to get there. Yeah, exactly. And if you can exceed it, or if you don't get there, then not getting there might have nothing to do with your capability or your preparation or anything to do with you, which is the heartbreaking part of sport.
Yeah, totally.
So these days in your post-racing career, do you set goals for yourself? Do you feel a bigger sense of purpose? What's driving you now?
Yeah, I think it's probably pretty similar. Like with the broadcast stuff, I did the commentary for the World Cups for a couple of years, and that was super cool. I think that I had kind of missed that performance aspect of racing where you're just like, all right, turn on, don't mess up, it's live kind of thing. Like we were talking about that, like non-live versus live before we started. And and that was something I really enjoyed, and just trying to figure out how to be the best I could be. I remember the first time I did the commentary, so I like played the expert role, and I was like, you know, I know the sport, I've raced this track, I've talked to everyone, I've walked it, blah, 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 blah. And Rob was like, why don't we go into qualifying and do a little practice? And I was like, yeah, cool. And so the first person kind of went down, and I was like, yeah, okay, there they go, looking around a turn. Okay, they're across the finish line. I was like, oh my God, I have no idea what to say. And so it was this moment of like, oh, I need to prep. Like I need to, there is a level, there's like levels to this as well, right? Where you need to pull the string. And Rob was a super good mentor. And so that was really fulfilling to find that in commentating. It's kind of see that expert role as like the director of attention. Yeah. So like, how do I point out something? How do I give you context? And so when you kind of think about it like that, like what is the right way to do it? How do you move something? How do you move the broadcast forward? And how do you make it interesting? How do you like manage the excitement through like an extended period of time? But then also within each run, you're trying to tell that story or whatever, you know, and give people kind of the quality that they deserve when they're doing this amazing thing. And so I think that, again, it's kind of like showed up in the same way where it's still that idea of trying to figure out what the process is and like digging really deep. And I think that it's a little bit more simple for me than racing at this point, but the commentary is really the payoff. After I've done all of the work, like we had some really cool broadcasts. Like there was one or two that I was just like, that was the best. That was the best. Like it was so good. And there's definitely been ones where I'm like, I want to crawl in a hole and never see anyone again. But
it's just like racing. You got your peak moments and then you have the days that don't go.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So I think about that. Like Red Bull's not doing the World Cups now, but we're doing like a studio show, and we have that podcast and still doing some other like kind of broadcasty stuff. And I enjoy that. I think it's like an exploration of how do you like succinctly articulate why something is as difficult or as interesting as you see it, you know, or as we see it as athletes kind of thing.
Yeah. I like your description of it as being the director of attention, because you're guiding people who don't necessarily know what would be interesting, or to show them, you know, even just hearing you talk about like line choice is so interesting to me, because you're guiding my attention to the things that you would look for and think about that I would never look for or think about. And I think that's a really beautiful thing to do.
Totally. I mean, I feel like we all get glimpses of this during the Olympics, because their job is to like take the viewer from nothing. Like I never watched curling or ping pong.
Yeah.
I know nothing about it. But I'm also watching the highest level game in the world. Like this is the pinnacle of the sport. And so how do you take someone from no knowledge to understanding this nuance? And they do a really, really good job of it. Like most of the Olympic commentators are really good. And I'm not a big football fan. Like I don't watch football, but Tony Romo is also amazing at this. Like he'll say, and he was like one of the, he was one of the people I like studied a lot, where he would be able to kind of look at the play and say, oh, watch number 13. I think they might try to do this. So like, these are the places that you're going to watch, where for me, like not knowing anything about football, I would just see it happen. And I would be like, oh, I think I caught the ball. Like, I think it got thrown here. But when he would do that, you would be like, oh, there it is. I see that happening. He just faked this person out. He threw the ball over here. Like that person is going to, you know, this running back is going to catch it over here. And so you could see it happening in real time. And without him kind of directing you to where you needed to put your eyes, you would have no idea.
It's such a balance too, because you're conveying information and you're educating, but it's not just that either. You're trying to get people excited about it. And that what you're describing, that anticipation of like, oh, is that going to happen there?
Totally. What's,
you know, that's amazing.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. But then like not predicting, right? Because like if you were like, hey, I think he's going to throw the ball. Or for me, if it's like, I think he's going to be faster at the split, then if you're right, then you've ruined the race. And if you're wrong, then you're wrong. So
right.
Like what is the, there's also, I think like an ego, you know, in service of the broadcast or of the rider, not so much of you as the commentator kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's another great way of looking at it too, that you're in service of, you know, the athlete and casting them in a, in a light that's going to be interesting and engaging and
100%
honoring everything that they've done to be there. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like my, like my number one boss is like the athlete, and then my second boss is like the producers at Red Bull. And then that's pretty much it. Like, I, like obviously the, like I want the fans to enjoy it, but I think if I feel like my job is to explain what this person was trying to do with their bike and they're happy with it, then I've done a good job, and I tell a good story kind of thing. So
I love that. That's awesome. So in your career, I mean, this is a way of giving back to the sport, and you are well known for giving back to the sport. And I'm curious, is there a time that you did something that had a really positive impact that really surprised you?
The two that are coming to mind, one, I was doing this. So my teammate on Pivot was Bernard Kerr, and he's one of my best friends. And, I was doing this kind of show episode for Outside, and we interviewed a bunch of people, and I did a little Zoom with him. And he said, I can't remember what the question was I asked him or something was, but one of them was, I think like, what is something that I've taught you, or what did you learn from me or something, or how do you think about me? I can't really remember, but he said, I used to kind of be scared of retiring, or not, maybe not scared, but like I used to kind of fear it or think it was like a down part of your life. But now seeing you doing all that you do, I'm like excited about it. And that was something that I was like, wow, that was super, super cool.
And the, like, anything you did know, intentionally, just
totally. Yeah. It's just happened.
You.
He just happened to see it in that way. So that's always like really stuck with me, just being who I am and doing what I'm doing. Like you can inspire people that even that you are inspired by, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And inspire in ways that you didn't expect or intend.
Totally. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And you said there was a second story that you were thinking of.
Oh yeah. This is totally different, but, I did a photo shoot, and it was kind of like a movie-ish thing. Like it was like SAG thing, so the Screen Actors Guild, and like there were so people that I never worked with. And at the end of the shoot, one of the, I think it was like the production manager, was like, he said, my life is better because I met you. And I was like, that is actually the coolest thing I've ever had anyone say to me. Like, is the highlight of, yeah, like that line and where he said it to me at, like, will stick with me the rest of my life. And I just thought it was so cool that he said that.
Oh my gosh. That is, yeah, that's like the ultimate compliment right there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Well, the title of this podcast is the Be a Good Wheel podcast. And I feel like that's sort of like encapsulates the whole thing, right? You know, if you can make somebody's life better just by existing. I mean, and honestly, truly, I think that is the case for most people. And it's not something where I'm going to think on a day-to-day basis, like, I'm making people's lives better just by being me. But we do. Right?
Yeah. And for sure, like, I think we've, like, I feel like all of us have felt that about someone. Like,
yes.
Yeah, I'm a better person. I'm happy. Like, my life is just better because I know this person.
Yeah. On that note, who has been, and I know it's probably more than one person, but just off the top of your head, who's somebody who's been a good wheel for you in your life?
Yeah, so many people. Probably because I'm about to go on a little vacation with him. My friend Lucas Shaw is, every time there's like something that's happening in my life, like, I'll just call him and he just says the perfect thing. And yeah, like, I don't know, he's just been like such a good friend. Like, he's a downhill racer, like one of the best downhill racers, and I can just ride with him, you know, hang out, we can go on vacation, but then yeah, they're in the perfect time. So I feel like that range is something that's really difficult to find. And I appreciate him.
Oh, that's so great. Shout out. And yeah, we should all be so lucky to find such a good wheel. Like, I think, yeah. So before we wrap up, I really want to talk about, you've got a couple of really cool initiatives going on. So I want to hear about the Grow Cycling Foundation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Let's see. A quick pitch. It is a nonprofit that we started, what, like 3 years ago now. And our mission really is to create opportunity for underrepresented people using the bike. Because I think for me, in cycling, it's given me so much. Like, all of the things that we've talked about today is because I rode a bike. But that doesn't, those like pathways don't exist for everyone. You know, when I was racing, I was like one of the only people of color there. And I think for a lot of people, it just comes down to like, what are you exposed to, right? Like, even going back to that idea of just serendipitously meeting someone at a dirt jump spot that happened to convince me to go to Whistler.
The dude at the dirt jump spot. I love that.
Totally. Right. And so I think that, if you said, how do you make those moments a little bit less serendipitous? And I think that that's kind of what we're trying to do. So our first initiative was building this pump track in Inglewood, California. So it's a community mostly majority of color. They're super ambitious. They just held the Super Bowl. And we built this 30,000 square foot pump track. It's $1.2 million. And so we raised the money. And it's kind of the only pump track in a radius of about 3 or 4 million people, at least.
Wow.
And we had opening day. There was like maybe like 1,000 kids came out. And it was just super special to see, you know, I'd talk to kids being like, oh, I told my mom that I was going to come here. And she said, you can't take the bus. It's too far. And then I told her it was only 6 minute ride away. So like, I think that was one of those moments where I went there and I was in my bubble. I was in, you know, my cycling industry bubble, you know, avid cyclist bubble. And when you go there, there were so many people that I just had never imagined going there, even on the first day. So I think that that was really cool. So I think we kind of think about things as like, you have two levers to pull. One's access and one's community. If you don't have a place to ride, you can't ride a bike. That could be anything. It could be pump track or bike lanes or trails or velodrome or whatever. And then if you don't have people to ride with, then it's also uninteresting.
Yeah.
Kind of that idea of like sport desire. Like, why would I do this in the first place? So for us, it's about saying, okay, the bike can allow you to go and race downhill, compete for your country in the world championships. It can let you be a product manager at Trainer Road. It can, you know, it can provide friendship, or you can be an engineer, an artist. And so how do we create as many of those pathways as possible just by kind of giving people the tools that they need and kind of empowering them with the opportunities that they could want and just allowing people to have the choice?
Yeah.
And it's been super cool. Like it's work with my mom, and that is one of the most fulfilling things ever. Pulled her out of retirement. And so we talk about it almost every day. And, yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 Like she's like the most incredible woman ever. And I'm just really, really excited about it. And even just going back to that thread of, for me, the providing the opportunity, building something for like the young Jackson family, if you will, and having an outlet for like my business strategy partnership section of myself. Like, it's cool. Like, I love it. And it's been great.
Well, it's also your software developer side of yourself, because I was checking out the website totally. And you have a whole app for the pump track, which is so brilliant, because you've created a physical gathering place, but you've also created a virtual component of it and gamified it, and you're bringing in, you know, participation of sponsors. I mean, honestly, it's just like, from a product management perspective, this is just sheer brilliance.
Okay. Thank you, Amber. Thank you. Yeah. It was even like that, like the kind of the strategy and ego piece of that. One of the reasons why we wanted to do that was because we built the pump track, and there was a bunch of people who kind of like claimed it on Instagram. Like, we had a fence up for a long time, and a bunch of like skateboarders and bike riders would like come hop in and then post on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube, like, just found this secret pump track, like, blah, blah, blah. And like, all good. It was so funny. I felt so old and same time, because I was like, just stay out, please. But also like, hop the fence and come in and ride it.
There's like the curmudgeonly side of you.
Totally, like, totally. It's just like, just follow the rules. Like, just figure it out. But it was crazy, because there was like a couple people on Instagram that, like, some dude made like a LA pump track Instagram, and we were like, and he would go and post and be like, hey, nice, we just got the sod in, like, won't be long now. And like, you know, like, kind of making it seem like it was his. And so it was a super interesting like exploration of ego, because it was like, well, what's wrong with that, right? Like, if you want to own it, like, it's for, in their eyes, they just think it's this public place. They don't know that we spend all this time and money and like, whatever doing it. And why do we need them to know, kind of thing?
Right.
And so it's almost like the opposite to where, and we, so typically, like, right, when you're making a brand, it's like, cool, like, how do we own this space as much? And a lot of time you do that through content. And we're like, not a content company. And so it's like, well, okay, how do we actually enable people to make as much content as possible? Like, how do we give them some brand kit? Or like, you know, we're partnering with GoPro. Like, how do we make a bunch of ambassadors and like have people who have huge Instagrams for it? And the interesting thing that we have is like access to signage and being able to hold events there. And so if we can say, okay, the source of truth for this thing is like this app, so you can see what the hours are, you can see the events, like all of these different things. You can kind of check in, do your thing, little gamified experience. But I think it was super interesting to kind of think through that of, well, how do we make it so people actually know what is happening here? If we're not going to be the biggest Instagram or Facebook page of this place, and like, yeah, how do you tamp down your ego to say, like, I don't actually need people to know that we built it, because it's for everyone else, and that shouldn't even come into their mind. They should just enjoy the space.
That's such an interesting exploration, right? Because it's not just a thought experiment. It's a very real situation where you're having to have that gut check of, wow, this feels really crummy. And is it because I need credit for what we did? And the thing you've done being building this for the community to own, really, you know, and like that idea of, but I think what you've done is a beautiful, because there's a balance, right? Like, yes, you want people to feel like it's theirs, but also the source of truth is important too, right? Because the intended use and the rules, and how do you use it safely and with respect, and how do you honor the purpose and the intent of it? And those aren't unimportant. But how do you solve for that? And that I think what you've done is just like, it's a really elegant solution. It's very cool. Yeah,
thank you, Amber. Thank you.
So what other stuff do you guys have going on with Grow Cycling Foundation? I mean, that's a huge milestone that you've already hit. So I don't want to like, oh, totally. That was cool, let's move on. But you know, what else do you guys have going on?
No, yeah. So like one of the big things that we've had going on for a little while now is the jobs board. So it was kind of like this cycling industry jobs board. And so that has been really cool. I've heard a bunch of people who have gotten jobs through there, which is like crazy. One of the people, Hannah Knapp, who is the kind of social media person at Pink Bike outside, she was like, oh yeah, I found my job. I was like, no way. That's amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So that's been really cool. And then I think right now, just kind of like taking a little bit of a beat to say, we've got this space up. Let's see how the community engages. We are trying to be like really intentional about, talking to as many people as we can. We have some cycling school programs in Inglewood as well. Like the goal is to obviously have some in every single school. But I think it's about saying right now, what's the right way to engage? And even back to the idea of, pulling the string and depth, not breadth. What does it look like to create this like cycling ecosystem here? So back to the opportunity piece, you can go here and get a job. Like, how do we introduce people? How do we do training? How do you do mechanicking things? What are the holes that exist? And then how do we like systematically like fill all of them?
That is really cool. Well, where can people find more information and how can they support what you're doing?
Yeah, you can go to growcyclingfoundation.org and find everything you need to there. You can follow us on Instagram too, Grow Cycling Foundation. You can donate. We have some different initiatives that kind of pop up every now and then, like partnering with companies and stuff like that. So that's super cool. So when you see one of those, and then I don't know, back to your idea of like being a good wheel, I think is kind of the most important thing. Because if everyone kind of, yeah, if everyone kind of does their part and invites people in, and or even more so kind of empowers people to take the path that they've taken, I think that it makes our job easier and in some cases obsolete, which is amazing.
Yeah, right. That's kind of, it's funny to say that, but it is sort of the point, right? Like, wouldn't it be nice if all of these effort, like we didn't need to put in the effort to make these efforts, and that is totally ultimately the goal.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's a beautiful way of tying it back. So thank you so much for that plug. And thank you for coming on the show. This has been a lot of fun. I feel like we could even dig deeper on a lot of what we talked about today, but we'll maybe save that for a future episode. And thank you so much, Elliot. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you, Amber.
As an interviewer, it's my job to ask questions of my guest, but this conversation with Elliot got me asking myself new questions, which I love. I also love how much of what he describes runs counter to many traditional assumptions about performance, and how much his insights apply beyond the competitive arena. He makes clear how important it is to commit to finding what works for you, because it might be different from what you first assumed would work. Lean into that space between bullet points, folks, because as Elliot points out, that's where the growth happens, and where we find the most interesting and exciting moments in life. Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you loved today's show, remember to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. The Be a Good Wheel podcast is produced by our wizard behind the curtain, Maxine Philibong. Find all published episodes and sign up for our newsletter at beagoodwheel.com. You can also listen wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the show comes entirely from listeners like you. Support us on Ko-Fi and Patreon to get monthly Q&A episodes, official Be a Good Wheel merch, and more. You can submit questions for Q&A episodes at beagoodwheel.com. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi. Unlike Patreon, Ko-Fi doesn't take a fee, so 100% of your support goes to the show. Go to ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Learn more about how to support us at beagoodwheel.com/support. Until next time, thanks for listening, and thanks for being a good wheel.